Blue 42. Blue 42. Omaha. Omaha. Set. Hut.
Well, Paul, that really looked like it's a first down for Spooner.
All right, first down. Huddle up. Huddle up.
Welcome to Therapists in Motion Podcast, brought to you by Spooner.
Welcome back to Therapists in Motion Podcast. This is Dan hosting again. I am joined on this podcast as my co-host with Becca Hibbert.
Hello.
And we are on location with a very special guest, and I'm going to let Becca introduce her.
I am very excited today because we have Sue Falzone with us. And if you've been to the Huddle in previous years, you know that we've been very lucky to have her speak. And we're lucky again because she's coming back this year to speak with us. April 5th and 6th is the Huddle, just a reminder, in downtown Phoenix. We'd love to have you. If you're unable to come, we also have a virtual option. But beyond that, let's talk about Sue Falzone. I've introduced her before on stage, and I know she didn't love it, but I'm going to do it again. If you are an AT or a PT and you don't know who she is, I'm just going to tell you there's probably something wrong.
You're probably living under a rock.
Yeah, and you might want to get out of that rock and just look it up real quick.
Really, come on.
You guys are kind.
But also, I've said this before, you know, they often say, don't meet the people that you look up to because they will let you down. But as an athletic trainer, Sue has always been somebody that I've looked up to, and I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, it is not a letdown to meet you. You're an amazing person, and Dan and I are very thankful that you were able to be on the podcast with us. So thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thank you for coming on location to do the podcast. That's super lovely. So yeah, I appreciate the kind words, and I'm happy to be here.
So let's start a little bit. I think, again, if our listeners don't know who you are, one, they probably do live under a rock, and they probably recognize you because of your duration and tenure in all of the major professional sports. But what some people may not know is more about your educational background and in the educational company that you run, that personally, even though I'm terrified of putting a needle through somebody's skin, is what is going to be the most transformative in our profession. And I mean our profession as both physical therapists and athletic trainers. And your company's name is Structure and Function. So can you just give a little background on, you know, why you started it, what the rationale behind it is, a couple of the course offerings, and then we'll kind of diverge and go off of that.
Sure. Gosh, I started Structure and Function Education maybe 8 years ago now, I think it was. And it was after I had left the LA Dodgers, I had left Athletes Performance. I think it was even after the US men's national team that I was with. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I was passionate, always been about passionate about education and about bridging the gap between rehab and performance and sort of blending that space between strength and conditioning and rehab. And I've never wanted to have to choose the letters after my name to be defined by, right? Like, I am an athletic trainer, I'm a physical therapist and a strength and conditioning coach. And I'm passionate about being all three of those things. And so I wanted to start an education company that sort of served all three of those professions. And at the time I was teaching dry needling for Dr. Ma way back in the day, and had the opportunity to sort of branch out onto my own, and sort of starting with dry needling was a bit of low-hanging fruit for me, for lack of a better way to put it. And so I started there, but I never wanted to just be a dry needling education company, even though that's really what we're known for. I wanted to be an education company and sort of be able to do exactly that, bridge the gap between rehab performance and sort of serve all three of those professions. And so, you know, I structure and function, even with the little ampersand in our name, means something to me. Like, first of all, structure and function is SAF, which is Susan Ann Falzone, which is my full name.
Love it.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't kind of, I didn't want to name my company after me. So SAF is, yeah, my initials. And then, you know, to me, it's always been about structure and function, right? If we understand our anatomy, then we understand our function better and our movement better. And I've always felt like when I didn't understand something, if I went back to anatomy, I would understand it more. And so to me, those two things, structure and function, are very co-entwined. And so that's where those two things came from. And then the ampersand in the middle of that education company, I read somewhere, which may or may not be true, but it's true in my brain, that ampersand in the way it's written is a broken infinity sign. And it means that, which you can look at it as a bad thing, but I looked at it as a positive, was that, you know, nothing lasts forever and there's always an and. And so, you know, after I left the Dodgers and left Athletes Performance, you know, I kind of thought, maybe I committed career suicide and I would never get a job again. And, you know, and then I realized, no, there's always an and we get to write our own story, and that even great things don't last forever. And that's okay. And there's always an and. And so that meaning to that symbol meant a lot to me. And so that's sort of how it all got brought together. And then even our colors, right, green and purple, sort of green meaning like new and innovative, and purple meaning kind of like regal and high end, because I wanted it to be a high end education company, right? And not be about, I want to be about teaching really great education and passionate about that, but like always having it be new and innovative. So even right down to our colors of green and purple kind of all sort of tell that story and how we got here.
I love that so much. Like, that's an even better story than I would think. Like, all those things you thought about, even within the name, is that's just amazing to me. So you mentioned, obviously, I think it is probably most well known for being dry needling, but what are some of the other options that the education that you guys run, like what are some of the other offerings that you have?
Yeah, one of my favorite offerings that we have is our dissection course that we're actually doing this weekend in Dallas, which I'm a bit sad not to be there this weekend. This, I think, is the first dissection course we've hosted that I missed. But we host a dissection course for all professions, and we utilize fresh frozen cadavers versus embalmed cadavers, which allows us to move the cadavers and sort of appreciate the kinetic linking. And then depending on who's with us in class, we can look at it from a dry needling safety perspective and just really have the option to explore anatomy, which really elevates every portion of our practice, in my opinion. So it really goes beyond learning like a new technique, but elevates every technique that you know. So that's really one of my favorite classes that's going on this weekend. Then we also have our fascial manipulation classes, which we've partnered with Antonio Stecco and the Stecco Institute. And that is just one of my favorite, I would say, life sort of practice altering techniques that I utilize in my own personal practice, and just really flows with the dry needling stuff when we sort of look at fascial points and sort of the overlap of acupuncture points and sort of how East meets West through the fascia is really kind of cool. So that's one of my favorite offerings. And then this last year, we just started offering joint manipulation classes as well, and have partnered with one of my best and oldest friends, Sean Robeck, who's a chiropractor here in Phoenix. And yeah, so just sort of expanding our manual therapy offerings. And then finally, education surrounding my book that I wrote years ago, Bridging the Gap Between Rehab and Performance. And so that was a living class for a hot minute, but then the pandemic hit and kind of changed course. And so we've put a lot of that online. And so we have a full online education offering as well. And so, which includes a lot of the Bridging the Gap from Rehab to Performance courses. So yeah, kind of a full offering, which I think probably isn't really known.
Yeah.
No, I mean, when we were doing show prep, I was fascinated by that. And that would be one thing I would challenge our listeners, especially those listeners who have been out 3+ years, is to really consider the live dissection course. Because, you know, going through my fellowship a number of years ago through the Gray Institute and re-looking at anatomical photos from a different perspective and having those come to life, you know, after being out for 10 years, you know, post-graduation from PT school, I looked at it very differently, and it's changed the conversations I've had with colleagues, with patients, with student physical therapists. And so I would highly encourage people, even though I haven't taken it, I'm going to sign up for 2025, to not take for granted the fact that you knew anatomy when you were in physical therapy school, because that's very different than what you're doing now in the practice of working with patients every single day. And the ability that probably most of us in PT or AT school, our cadaver was embalmed. And so the ability to move it freely was probably not the same as what it will be with a non-embalmed cadaver. And so I think that's just fascinating to me.
Yes, it's a completely different learning experience. And I think too, when you're learning anatomy from a perspective of inexperienced clinician, whether that be not, you know, only a year or two, or just, you know, 3 years of experience or 20 years of experience. When you can learn something when you don't have to memorize it for a test, it's a completely, right, completely different yes. learning opportunity. And then to have the fresh, frozen, non-embalmed is, again, a completely different experience because we can see movement, right? And isn't that what it's about, right? Anatomy shouldn't be living in isolation as this thing that we memorize. It's about how does this connect to that through skin, through adipose, through fascia, through, you know, through different tissues. And so we can really see that in the non-embalmed cadaver, which I think is so special.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's awesome then, you know, we talk about the huddle and bringing multiple professionals together, and you do the same thing in your continuing education where it's open to athletic trainers, it's open to strength coaches, it's open to physical therapists. That mentality of coming together with all the other professionals that are involved in treating athletes is fantastic. We had a fun interaction with Sue's dog and a squeaky toy that you might slightly be able to hear in the background. So we apologize, but you know, that's the joy of our podcast and the inability for me to go edit that out. So if you hear a squeak, well, you just know that Richard was here playing with a squeaky toy. But you know, as I was kind of alluding to, can you talk about, like, again, you have all three credentials, but how that is truly important in what you've done in your professional career of working with strength coaches and athletic trainers and fellow physical therapists and skill coaches and general managers, but also how that's morphed in your education company to say, look, I want to provide education to all the people who want to come to my courses.
Yeah, I think for me, In sports medicine, there's just overlap, right? In with what athletic trainers do and physical therapists do and chiropractors do and acupuncturists and massage therapists, right? Like, nobody owns one thing. There's overlap in everything we do, right? And isn't that a beautiful thing? Like, thank God we all do CPR, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. There's certain things that, right, like, can I manipulate something? Sure. But you know what? If I've got a chiropractor who is really great at manipulation sitting right next to me, why wouldn't I refer that and create a patient-centered atmosphere,
yep,
and allow people's, you know, things to shine? Can an athletic trainer do rehab? Absolutely. Can a physical therapist do an on-field evaluation? Absolutely. But depending on who those people are and what their experiences have been, maybe they are better at certain things than others, right? And so I think we're more similar than we are different. And I think that's good and that's okay. And then there's areas that we are different. And again, that's good. And so, you know, for me, I'm just passionate about making sure that we create an open space. We leave our letters at the door. You know, it's not up to me. Strength coaches can't dry needle. So unfortunately, you know, we don't let strength coaches into that course, but they can take our dissection course. You know, and in our fascial manipulation and joint manipulation courses, you have to have a license that allows you to do manual therapy. And so there are certain laws that sort of restrict who can come into class and who can't. But I think that is the beauty of our dry needling classes, is in any given class, you've got physical therapists, athletic trainers, acupuncturists, and chiropractors all working together, leaving their letters at the door in the best interest of their patient. And that is patient-centered care. That is just beautiful to me. And I have always been passionate about that inclusivity in our coursework. And yeah, it's just super, super important to me.
In case anyone was wondering why Sue is really good at what she does, it's basically what she just said to you. And I think because what we've often seen, I've seen it in my own career, I'm sure both of you've seen it in your careers, it becomes competition when competition is unnecessary amongst sports medicine professionals, when it should be collaboration. Like, to your point, ultimately, somebody's probably better at something we're trying to do. Let's let that person do it. Let's learn from those people. And like you said, then that puts the patient, the athlete, at the center of care. And isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? I mean, if we all think we're the best, then we're really out there for ourselves. We're not out there trying to take care of the athlete at the highest level. So I just want to thank you for saying that. I mean, I know that's how you think, but I think it's really important for everybody that's listening to really understand this is one of the reasons that you are one of the best in the professions, because you understand that and because you treat at that level too, with that understanding. And so thank you. Really appreciate that.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I think the longer I'm out too, right? I just said earlier that, oh my word, I graduated PT school 28 years ago, which is inappropriate. I am not okay with that number. Wow. Like, it was shocking to me when I said that earlier. But, you know, the longer you're like, the more I've been out, the less I feel like I know, right? And there's just so much. And especially in this day and age, like, we can't be the best at everything. We just can't. We have to be intercollaborative in the best interest of our patient. Like, that just has to be. And so, yeah, I try to really live that. And I've been in situations where I've been able to live that, which is really great. And, you know, I was kind of joke, like, I like to be the silo between the silos, you know, and be able to sort of be able to bridge that gap, not to continue to, like, hashtag my book name, but but to really, yeah, you know, but to really be able to bridge that gap. Because for me, I think that's really where the power lies, right? Is we know that there's no one day where rehab ends and strength and conditioning begins. And we know that there's a blend there and a continuum there. So how do we really sort of bridge all of those things together? That's where I think the power is.
Well, and you know, I'm glad that you bring that up, because just yesterday, a colleague and I were at a high school here in the Valley that we're, you know, attempting to develop a sports medicine brand and care team with. And that's what we spoke to their athletes and their coaches about, is it's, you know, our goal working with them is to keep them on the field or on the court playing. It is not to have them on the sidelines with us. And even if they're dealing with, you know, an irritated elbow or an irritated shoulder, we were talking about to baseball kids, that doesn't mean that they can't still work on hitting mechanics and be a DH and work on, you know, base running and stealing and still have a significant impact for their team. And that perspective I have realized over the last 7 years, that, again, kind of like what you just alluded to, it's a different approach than what I had thought when I was in athletic training and then my early stages in physical therapy. It was like, it was almost an all or none type of ordeal. And I didn't see the full picture of that blend and allowing an athlete to do something at practice or in the weight room versus, no, you haven't been cleared medically or you haven't been cleared for your concussion protocol. And therefore it was an all or none.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm going to bring this back around to there, but I also teach at AT Still University in their Doctorate of Athletic Training program. And Andrew Taylor Still, who the university is named after, is the founder of osteopathic medicine. And I love osteopathic medicine and the philosophy of mind, body, spirit medicine that really resonates with me as a human and as a clinician. And so one of my favorite quotes from him is that it is the job of the physician to find health. Anyone can find disease. And I think that quote is really powerful, right? Because it's easy for us as clinicians to sit around and say, oh, you can't throw, you can't do this, you have a weak rotator cuff, your scapular stabilizers aren't doing, right? All the things that are wrong with them versus, no, you can practice base stealing, you can do practice hitting, you can do all of these other things while we work on upskilling some of these other things. And that our words matter, and that instead of having that focus for the patient of, oh, here's all the things that are wrong with you. I mean, anybody can say that, right? What are the things that we can do while we're rehabbing this other thing? And I think that's a really important message for the patient, and can help reframe their mindset.
And it's a really hard conversation for us as professionals to think that way, because, you know, you think about what we're taught in most didactic curricula, it's the impairment. It's not what they can do. And there was an interesting study that came out of, it was either Australia or New Zealand, don't quote me on that. And I think it was published in JOSPT last summer, where they took an approach with individuals who were historically diagnosed with bone-on-bone osteoarthritis, and they took that language out of the physician and the PT's vernacular, and they tracked over time what the patient was able to do. And that's how they talked about everything, is here's what I want you to keep doing. And it delayed the vast majority of them from having any other intervention necessary because of the power of that language from a collaborative healthcare team talking about what they could do versus, well, you can't do this and you're bone on bones, you're going to need surgery, or you're going to need an injection, or you're going to need X, Y, and Z, and it's only a matter of time before you have to have a major reconstructive surgery.
Isn't that powerful? I need to find that study.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, that is so powerful, right? And just how, like, the way our words and how we frame those things to patients and how, what, like, how impactful that is in their lives, right? But you're right, like, insurance companies, because the majority of people are going to practice an insurance-based sort of scenario, and insurance companies don't want to hear about what patients can do. They want to hear about their impairment to justify the therapy. And isn't that a sad way to do it, right? Like, dentists have it figured out, right? They'll pay for your cleaning 100% twice a year. But man, if you need a root canal, you're paying out of pocket for that, right? So, like, the dentist industry, dental industry has it figured out.
So let's talk a little bit, and you know, Becca and I are going to be basically innocent bystanders after I ask this question, since neither of us have taken the course. But can you talk about the approach of utilizing trigger point dry needling in an acute situation as compared to when something else hasn't worked or you've exhausted all your other manual therapy approaches, you know, which I think a lot of people probably say, okay, yep, I'm going to use that with some, you know, more chronic type conditions, but utilizing in an acute injury and how you utilize trigger point dry needling on that situation.
Yeah, there's different techniques, and in the United States, dry needling is a very broadly used term. And, you know, when you sort of look at, definitions, right, of like trigger point dry needling versus just dry needling, right, things get a little bit muddy. I'm probably not supposed to say the A word, right, the acupuncture word, right, but but it is muddy in the United States versus in other countries. And so, you know, I tend to just use the phrase needling because I do have a bit of an eclectic practice, and I am trained in some traditional Chinese medicine outside of this country in the UK, which nobody in this country cares about. And in Spain and sort of in Italy and different areas of the world that I've studied in. And so I do probably have a more eclectic approach to needling than maybe just a true trigger point approach. And so when we look at needling as a whole, we have to remember that there are different techniques and there's different ways to use the needle, whether it is a pistoning technique, which can be used not only in trigger points. Oh, there goes Richard again. He's barking. Hopefully you all can't hear that. He really is in every podcast that I have ever done. So
to introduce him as an extra guest.
Yes, I think it's just fitting that he is showing up for this one as well.
His photo might just be the photo for the promo.
He is on our website, my website, as the director or the CEO of Snuggles. So he is part of the C-suite of Structure and Function Education. I don't even remember what we were talking about. But, so needling and going back to utilizing needling in an acute scenario. And so there's different techniques of needling. So we can piston and use a pistoning technique, and we can do that technique at a trigger point. We can do that technique at a bone, as you have maybe experienced as well. And so we can leave a needle in situ. We can attach an e-stim to the needle and do different things as well. So there's lots of different techniques that we can do with a needle. We can wind a needle, you know, like a watch in one direction. We can do a bi-directional winding of the needle where you go back and forth. And we do all of these different techniques to elicit different physiological responses. And so the way we needle in an acute situation is maybe different than the way we would needle in a more chronic situation. And not only where, but not only how we needle, but where we needle in an acute situation may also be different. So I always try to just bring things back to a local response, a segmental response, and a systemic response, because we're going to get all three of those reactions from someone. And so if we use the example of someone having elbow pain, if I put a needle at somebody's elbow, in their left elbow, and they're having left elbow pain, we're going to get local responses, segmental responses, and systemic responses. If I put the needle in the opposite elbow, I take the local effects out of it, but I'm still going to get segmental responses, right? I'm still going to get C4 through C6-ish stimulation, right? So I'm still going to get segmental responses as well as potentially systemic responses. But let's say somebody has a CRPS situation and you don't want to stimulate a segment. Well, I could put a needle in their foot or in their ankle or in their leg and forego my local responses, forego my segmental responses, but still get systemic responses. And then the systemic responses are variable because systemic responses are reliant on the release of our own endogenous opioids and monoamines and sort of all of that stuff. So just like, I don't know from looking at Becca, does she need one Tylenol to manage her pain? Does she need three Tylenol to manage her pain? Right? I don't know how much systemic stimulation is going to be required for her to release enough endogenous whatever to manage her pain and inflammation. So the systemic responses are much more variable than a local response, and the segmental responses are somewhere in between. So I try to always just go back to, what are we doing locally? What are we doing segmentally? What are we doing systemically? And then that helps drive our, if we know our why, right? Like there's a whole book written about start with why, right? So if we start with why am I putting a needle in someone? The point is not to put needles in people. The point is to stimulate a physiological response that helps people load and move better. And so if I continue to go back to that why and continue to go back to my local segmental systemic responses, then I can appropriately select the location and the technique that I'm going to use, along with whatever's going on with the patient as a whole, right? So I kind of respect those three things.
Well, and I think it's important, even just listening to you talk, we go back to the discussion about dissection. I mean, how much did you just talk about there, that if you don't understand the anatomy or you haven't been updated on it, or to your point of the way that you guys do dissection, okay, we've done dissection, but the body's just there versus moving. Yeah. Okay. What is the difference of how the body responds, how it's, you know, the function? And so I just think it's incredible. And I appreciate the fact that you said, you know, you called it, you have the symbol in the middle, because, and like things will continue, because that's what we know about medicine. It is always changing. How we take care of people is changing. To even Dan's point, 10 years ago, we didn't have as many sports psychologists, mental performance coaches. Mm-hmm. We didn't have as many people telling us we need to talk more about what people can do versus their restrictions. And so it's just, it's important, no matter what we're doing, that we're continuing to stay up to date on all of these things. And to your point, I think you may have said it before the show started, even you learn something every new when you go into that dissection class, because there's so, the body is such an incredible thing. And to your point, everybody's response to what we do is completely different. So what they need, we kind of have to, I mean, obviously we're not going to harm anybody, but we do have to test out different strategies and see what works for certain people, understand the body at a much higher level. And let's be honest, we all forget things. So it's never a bad idea to be reminded about anatomy or how the body works, because there's a lot that goes on in our day-to-day lives, and we are going to forget some of the things we've learned along the way if we don't keep up on our continuing education, for sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the anatomy for me and physiology, you know, I almost failed out of physical therapy school because of physiology. I mean, truly.
Same.
I mean,
AT school though.
Yeah, it was really touch and go there for a hot minute. Gosh. So yeah, right. Like anatomy and physiology, and yeah, that is the great thing about needling. My needling journey is it has forced me to learn physiology, because I did not like physiology. And so it really forced me to learn that. And if we continue to go back to those foundations of, you know, anatomy and physiology, it's just like your house. You know, you can put great windows and great doors and decorate all you want, but if your foundation is not good, none of that matters. And so that foundation, we want all the new shiny toys, right? And that comes from someone who teaches new techniques to people all the time. And those are great. And you should absolutely come to those courses because they're great. But, you know, but the foundation of some of these things, if you know that foundation, then you can apply that to anything.
Yeah. I mean, just sitting here thinking about my journey and things that I was apprehensive about a long time ago and sometimes still are, you know, I wonder how many things I've missed because of my own apprehensions and my fears. And so I'm going to have to spend some personal time reflecting to see if maybe dry needling is in my future and I can overcome the fear of putting a needle through somebody's skin, since my PT school classmates, if they happen to listen, God help them, but they could definitely tell you that I did not want to cut through the skin in cadaver dissection or during residency. My poor fellow residents were like, Dan, when are you going to do something? I'm like, I'm going to do something with you guys. Get this skin cut, please.
Why Dan is not a surgeon.
Right, exactly. Goodness sakes. And I almost failed organic chemistry, so I wasn't smart enough to be that. I was almost not smart enough to be a physical therapist, too.
Yeah, if
you asked that person that interviewed me at the med center, they told me I wasn't smart enough.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. But yeah, OCHEM will take you down well. Absolutely. And there's a lot of people that come to class that are fearful of needling. And some people get over that during class, and you'd be amazed, you know, they're practically blow darting the needle in by the end of the weekend, you know, and other people, not so much. And that's okay. Right. But I think it is a modality that a lot of people are using, and, you know, whether you use it in your personal practice or not, you're going to have athletes, you're going to have patients that are asking you about these things. And so the more you can educate yourself to them, so you can help guide your patient, right? Even if you're not the one doing the dry needling, whether you refer out or not, it's good for you to understand, so you can help your patient make an informed decision about the best treatment for them.
Absolutely.
And we always talk about, and I say it probably more than anybody else, at the end of the day, it's so important to know when you're not the source of care, where your resources of care are. And that kind of circles back even to your point of working with other professionals as well, because it's okay if we're not the source, but having those resources, knowing the correct people to send our athletes, our patients to, makes us just as valuable as the person who's providing the care. And I think we always have to keep in mind that, you know, knowing where and when to send people to other people is just as important when we're taking care of patients and athletes too.
No doubt. And, you know, people think that I have all this needling experience. I refer to acupuncturists all the time. There's lots of things that come to me that are beyond my scope. Just because I can doesn't mean that I should. And just because I can stick needles in people doesn't mean that I should do that for every complicated internal medicine diagnosis that maybe comes through the door. So, you know, I think that interdisciplinary connection between acupuncturists and clinicians who are dry needling is really important.
Thank you again to Sue for being with us today. Honestly, we could talk to you for hours, but that would be unfair to your time. But we really appreciate all the knowledge that you bring. And just a reminder, once again, to everyone listening, if you can join us April 5th and 6th at the Huddle, we'll be downtown Phoenix. We would love to have you. Otherwise, as mentioned, we also have virtual options. And that way, if you're unable to make it, you can still listen to Sue and all of our great speakers that are going to be joining us this year.
And as always, if you have any questions, comments, feedback, or topic suggestions, please do not hesitate to reach out to us at therapistinmotion@spoonerpt.com. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Please hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app.